is erroneous and inciting violence. With Kimmel back on air, how will Mom Donnie erupt? Maybe send ICE to Disneyland? And government shutdown coming. Another layer of night darkness as the politicos play the blame game and Trump continues to insult and threaten any opposition. Then after fall, as Gil Scott Heron sang, it's winter in America and ain't nobody fighting cause nobody knows what to save. Or at least no one can agree. As they say on airplanes, make sure your oxygen is flowing before helping someone else. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, September 24th, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-801-1378. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Anna Wilcox, David Rosenberg, Dan Raphael, Dave Johnson, and Althea Billings. The producer is Dave Johnson, and our engineer is Ray Bodewell. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of the evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH, Philomath, on 104.3 FM, and K220HR, Hood River, on 91.9 FM. I'm Terrence Burns.
And I'm Anna Wilcox. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I'm joined by Jake Thomas, correspondent with Street Roots, to talk about his latest article for the paper. It's called Oregon Prison Leaders Promise Better Medical Care for Prisoners, but who's watching them? Welcome to the show, Jake.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you so much for being here with us to talk this through. So this new article of yours, you start by talking about a prisoner named Jacob Pizzo. He entered Oregon State Penitentiary a year ago and now is part of a lawsuit against the prisons. Why is that? Talk us through it.
So he entered prison, and his suit is really about medical care, about really the lack of medical care he was getting while serving time in the state penitentiary. A big issue was his teeth. His teeth were rotting, and they needed to be pulled out, and he needed dentures. And the suit states that prison officials were willing to pull his teeth out for his dentures, but they didn't want to actually get him set up with dentures because he had less than 2 years on his sentence. And so that he basically would have just been finishing out a sentence with no teeth. And on top of that, he had some mental health issues. He had opioid dependency, and it wasn't clear if he was getting treatment. He also had hypertension that ran really high. He just had a lot of medical issues that weren't being addressed in prison. And what's notable about this suit is that the lawyers representing the Department of Corrections, they defended these practices in court, saying that he hadn't been diagnosed with some of the conditions, that they'd offered to pull his teeth out. The records are kind of murky whether or not he got mental health treatment or got substance use treatment. But it's notable because they're defending this, his care, while prison officials have said that they're going to overhaul medical care completely, that they're going to really get rid of the red tape and make it a lot easier for prisoners to get care.
Well, right. This is related to a Street Roots investigation that first dug into the Oregon prison healthcare system. What was found in that one?
So So there's been a bunch of media reports, and there's been some outside accreditation agency looked at the state prison system, and then the state even called in lawyers to do an investigation. And all of this has found some really big problems with the prison system's medical care. It shows that prisoners have real delays in getting care. That there's just, they have this committee, this gatekeeping committee that prevents prisoners from getting outside, to going to outside specialists. It's just from my reporting, it sounds like a lot of prisoners have trouble getting staff to take their issues seriously. The big problem that they found is that there's a gatekeeping committee that has in the prison system that has prevents prisoners from getting access to specialists outside of the prison system, and also just getting a lot of their issues taken seriously and getting the appropriate care. The state investigation also found that there was just a culture of retaliation from the top. And since then, the Department of Corrections, they've fired two of the top health managers, and they brought in new leadership, and they brought a consultant that had laid out a lot of recommendations, and the prison system's leadership is in the process of overhauling medical care for prisoners.
Also sort of inspired by these investigations, both from official sources and also from media, including Street Roots, legislators at the state level were considering two bills this session to try to fix this.
Yes, during the legislative session, there, like you said, there was a pair of bills that were aimed at this issue. One of them would have mandated that prisons treat pre-existing conditions of prisoners. It also would have required prison medical staff to document anytime there is a anytime they deny a prisoner care. And then the other one would have just set some minimal staffing levels and also looked at wages for prison medical staff. And part of that was to just to make sure that there is enough staff and staff aren't being just overwhelmed and burnt out and they can do their jobs. However, neither of those bills made it through the session. They were introduced like kind of in the middle of the session. It wasn't really clear what the fiscal impacts were going to be, which is not good to have when the state has a pretty tight budget. So now they're made it out of the state's budget writing committee.
Speaking to the lack of health care that prisoners are getting, how widespread is this issue? How dire are the circumstances that prisoners are facing? Because it's almost, I think sometimes when you hear one anecdote, it sounds wrong, but I think understanding, you know, the systemic aspect of it and what is actually the consequence for folks is important here too.
That's a good question. And it's hard to answer because prisons by their nature are, they're closed off from the rest of the world. That they, you know, they don't have really a lot of outside people coming in. And so it's really hard to get a sense of just how widespread these issues are. I think one thing that is notable is that an independent accreditation group that looks at prison medical systems and makes sure that they're meeting some basic standards, they looked at Oregon's prison system last year, and they found a backlog of 600 healthcare appointments for women at the Coffee Creek Correctional Facility. And that includes things like annual wellness exams and preventative screenings. So that's one indication. The outside consultant that the state hired most recently didn't have a whole lot of exact figures. They looked at like some systemic problems with just policies and processes that were keeping prisoners from getting the right care. There's not a whole lot of documentation. And part of that is the state prison medical system, it still is very much a paper system. Requests for medical care are done with paper, and a lot of charting is done with paper. And so there's just like not a lot of documentation to show just what kind of how big the problems are, or just the scope of them.
There's a couple other individual prisoners' cases that you reference in the story that I would like to touch on here. Specifically, Lori Price, who I believe was incarcerated at Coffee Creek as well. Her conviction actually overturned. What was her experience of their healthcare system?
So it was really bad. It sounded so. From what she told me was that she had Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis, which are two really pretty serious inflammatory bowel diseases. She had hers under control with the right medications. But once she got to prison, they just took away her meds. They put her on different medications, and it just all got a lot worse. And so she told me that, you know, she was there for like 5 years, got out in 2018. And while she was there, she said she spent probably most of the time in the infirmary just because she was just so sick the entire time. And so when she was in there, her bowel diseases, they flared back up. And she described it as like razors in your guts. Just like anytime you move around, anytime you eat anything, just like you're just always in pain. So she was always requesting medical care. And eventually she also got a urinary tract infection, a staph infection in her lungs that was circulating in the prison, according to what she told me. And her colon had gotten so bad that she had become septic. And so she was taken to a hospital. And she said she was just completely like just delirious when she was there. And when she got there, they had to remove her colon, which sounded like it was just completely rotting and it just needed to be removed altogether.
You mentioned that there's been research into how the Oregon prison healthcare system works, but also in other prison systems around the country. What are some of the systemic reasons for such poor prison healthcare? You talked a little bit about it being siloed, but there's a couple other factors, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, it's siloed, and it's also just the organization. It's just kind of built into prisons where it's just command and control, where we're in charge of you. You know, like it's just real, power dynamic is present. I've read that there are, you know, I think staff, I talked to once a nurse who works in prison, and she was, you know, very dedicated. And I've heard that the staff is very dedicated and really does care. But I've also heard that they do, that there is some compassion fatigue, there is some burnout, and that they are overwhelmed. And so they're not really able to respond as well as everyone would like. I have heard that there, in my reporting, is that there are some states that are better at this because they bring in outside organizations. Like they bring in universities or the Department of, or like some sort of health and human services agency. And just having that outside, the presence of an outside group is really does help.
I think it's also worth noting that prisons are not able to take federal Medicaid dollars to support treatment as well.
Right. No, that's a good point. I'm glad you mentioned that because, Oregon has been really good about getting Medicaid dollars since the expansion of the Affordable Care Act. And it really does, it doesn't pay a lot, but it does subsidize a lot. It has been used to expand care. But the thing is prisons can't get that money. So they're not being subsidized by Medicaid. So they do have tight budgets. And I think that, and I've heard everybody say that part of that, you know, they can't get into the spigot of federal money, that they do have tighter budgets, and that does lead to prisoners getting less care.
What would you say are the main takeaways that you hope readers and listeners get from this story?
I think the main one is that over the summer, you had the prison leadership, you had Mike Reese, the director, came out, and you know they unveiled this consultant's report, and they said they have new leadership and they're really trying to make some real changes at the prison. And everybody I've talked to says that's sincere, and they are trying to get this fixed. But there needs to be oversight, just because, like I mentioned, the nature of prisons, they're very insular, they're siloed, there's not a lot of outside presence from outside groups. The question is, like, they say they're going to do it, but who's watching them? Who's going to make sure that they do it? The governor's office said that the ombuds, they've had a new ombudsperson who's going to be looking at the department. So I think that there really just does need to be oversight of the prison to make sure that they are doing these reforms. And also, I think it's worth, you know, there's been a lot of headlines about this recently, but I think that there is this lawsuit. And from what else I've heard, it sounds like that it has not. There's some indications that maybe that this idea to change prison medical care hasn't fully trickled down yet, and that's going to be one of the challenges.
If our listeners are interested in reading the full story for themselves, what's the best way for them to do that?
go support your local vendor. That's probably the best way. And then I know it does. The story does post online later, but I like paper and I like your vendor, so that's probably the best way, is go find the vendor.
Well, Jake, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me today. I really appreciate it.
Of course.
That was Jake Thomas, correspondent at Street Roots, speaking with me about his latest article. It's called Oregon Prison Leaders Promised Better Medical Care for Prisoners, But Who's Watching Them? After failed legislation renewed worries about health care for Oregon's aging and medically needy prison population, prison leaders promised to do better, but a court case raises questions about whether that commitment has trickled down. More information is online at streetroots.org. For KBOO News In Depth, I'm Althea Billings. Listening to KBOO News In Depth. Is artificial intelligence causing major job losses and making it difficult for new college graduates to find jobs? Writing for Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, John Jay College Research Assistant Connor Smythe says that corporate media has created an exaggerated narrative that AI is doing just that. KBOO contributor David Rosenberg spoke with Smythe about his findings.
AI and layoffs. So you think that the effect of AI on layoffs has been exaggerated? How could that be?
When my piece came out, basically my argument was that the media had picked up on the story about AI and layoffs specifically happening with new college graduates since really like the introduction of ChatGPT, but the story was only really picked up on in the spring of this year. And when it started being promoted from the spring through the summer, it seemed that basically the evidence wasn't really there in order to support the strong conclusions that were being made, at least in some of the reporting. And so my article was sort of an attempt to push back against that specific narrative and to say, like, we need to look more closely at the evidence and have really a stronger set of evidence to prove this claim. That was really the claim that ended up being in the media, that the main story of what was happening to new college grads in the deteriorating labor market for this group of people was AI was taking the jobs, which I think was basically an overstatement of what was occurring and still seems to be quite hard to support based on the data.
So the argument that people make who invent new technologies, new approaches, is that, yeah, some jobs will be lost, but new jobs will be created. So are they saying the same thing about AI?
Yeah, interestingly, some of the people who are spearheading AI and who are like the, you know, CEOs of AI companies seem to be saying something roughly like we're going to just see new jobs being created. Like, I think this is sort of what you see from Sam Altman, where he's talked about how we're just going to see very different jobs in the future. But on the other hand, you have people like Dario Amodei, who's the CEO of Anthropic, another large AI company, who was actually one of the people who was at the forefront of pushing this narrative of AI taking jobs from new college grads. And he made claims in the spring, I think, about how AI was going to lead to basically a bloodbath for white collar workers and was going to particularly hit new college grads hard. So there's just a split even within like the tech community, I think, about what the impact is going to be, with some people being more optimistic and some being more pessimistic.
So as far as college grads, or for that matter, people coming out of high school without college educations getting jobs, what could be causing the problems in getting employment?
So I think the main story that seems the most plausible would be that there's a lot more uncertainty in the economy right now as a result of mainly the Trump administration's approach to tariffs and the sort of on-again, off-again nature of their trade policy. So the fact that companies basically don't really know exactly what their costs are going to be a few months down the line, due to the high level of uncertainty in the economy, could be making these companies very wary about bringing on young workers who they would have to train and who represent sort of an investment in the future and who are not going to really be producing necessarily the value that these companies want to see until like maybe several months down the line, when, you know, tariffs could be in a completely different spot and costs could force them to lay off these workers. So that's uncertainty, I think, would be the rise in uncertainty in the economy would be the story that I would point to.
Do you think, or do you know if the AI / employment situation is being played differently in other countries by the media there or by spokespeople there?
I did see a little bit about it with the UK. I haven't really looked much at other countries, but in the UK, I think a similar thing is happening where there is a lot of fear about job loss and especially among younger workers. And so, you know, from some of the research that I cite in the article that I wrote on this topic was from the Financial Times, which was covering both the US and the UK. And it seems like there's something similar going on, but I'm not totally sure about countries beyond that. I wouldn't be that surprised if this is a more widespread phenomenon, but I think there are certainly some very substantial differences in how people in different regions of the world are reacting to AI. So certainly like the media coverage and public reaction should be expected to be quite different just based on what we've already seen, like in Western countries, or very maybe like rich countries in the West versus some other regions of the world. I think the attitudes are quite different.
So here, or maybe in the UK as well, it seems like there's a lot of anxiety about getting any kind of a job. And do you think that the AI situation makes it worse, or it doesn't really have an effect? What do you think about that?
I think the strongest evidence for it having an effect right now is probably with this group of younger workers, and specifically with workers in tech, where it seems much clearer, much more straightforward, the case for why AI could be replacing jobs in tech among young workers. And so I think like there's actually a recent paper out of Stanford that looks at this question of, are individuals whose occupations are more exposed to AI seeing a worse labor market, basically, or to phrase that in maybe a little bit of a clearer way, are occupations that are more exposed to AI seeing worse trends in job growth? And they actually find that for young workers who are in jobs that are highly exposed to AI, there has been a reduction in employment, whereas that's not true for people who are in occupations that are more highly exposed to AI. It's really hard to prove exactly what they're setting out to prove in this paper, and I'm not sure that they fully prove it here. For example, it's extremely difficult to set up a measure of how exposed jobs are to AI, but the paper does point to the possibility that there is some there, like there is something happening, but we definitely just need more research to get a better sense. But I think there's probably AI is responsible for some of the rise in unemployment for workers in particular sectors that are highly exposed to AI, and particularly for younger workers. But I think it's probably a relatively small part of the overall story. And it's probably even a small part of the story it's probably not the dominant story for like a group of workers like age 20 to 24 or something, just because there's so much else going on in the economy that's causing hiring to slow down, that it's hard to believe that AI would be the main driver, but it certainly could be a part of what's going on. But again, this is for like a small subset of workers. So overall, like in terms of the overall unemployment rate, I don't think AI is having much of an effect right now.
And is it, in your view, generally accepted that AI is going to be the wave of the future, or is there some pushback on that may shift things?
Yeah, this is a question that I am trying to figure out. I'm not sure. There's definitely splits about how impactful AI is going to be. So I think we can break people down into the views down into several different prominent camps. One would be that AI is sort of going to lead to a future utopia. One is that AI is going to lead to a future dystopia. And then one is that AI is a total bubble and it's essentially useless and the bubble is going to pop and we're not going to really see any major transformation as a result of AI. I think there's then also a sort of a fourth camp that I would probably align more with, which says like AI is seems the, like the most plausible path for AI seems that it's going to play out sort of like the large general purpose technologies of the past, like the internet. And there's going to be a significant economic impact of AI, but it's going to be felt over a much longer time horizon than many of the most prominent proponents and detractors of AI are claiming that it will play out. So it's going to be more on the time span of decades that we see these really substantial transformations of the economy. And there probably will be a significant labor market disruption, but it will be more in the form of a reshuffling of labor and creation of new jobs at the same time as old jobs are destroyed or old tasks are taken over by AI. And so jobs that we already know just change in form. And so I think that that's probably the most plausible scenario for AI. But I don't know exactly what the split is of people who are watching it, like where to place everyone like in these various camps. And I don't think that necessarily the majority of people would claim to be in like this fourth camp that I think is probably the most realistic view of what's going to happen with AI. But of course, there's just a high degree of uncertainty. So it's really hard to say for sure.
And how about our legislative bodies, the Congress and the state legislatures? Have they weighed in much on AI? Or is it like other technologies that it's just too new, too soon, and they don't understand it, that kind of thing?
There's certainly been some regulation, although I think at the federal level now, there's less of a willingness to impose regulation on AI. And there was, like, I believe, a ban or a curtailment on state-level regulation that was put in recent federal legislation. Although I'm less familiar about, like, sort of with the regulatory landscape currently, but my understanding is that it's relatively limited right now, just as people are getting accustomed to AI being a bigger part of the landscape. I think in the EU, there's much more regulation in place.
And, as there usually is.
Yeah.
Anything else you want to add to what you've said?
I would definitely recommend that for sort of like the media consuming public to really try to approach like the news about this with a very skeptical eye. Because there's going to be a lot of fear-mongering, I think, about AI in the near future. And the ability to sort of spin these narratives about AI having a really large negative impact on employment is just always going to be there because there's always just a massive amount of layoffs happening. You know, in my piece, I talk about how there's somewhere in the range of like 1.5 to 2 million layoffs per month going back over the last 25 years, just in a very typical period. And so if what we're concerned about is basically mass unemployment as a result of artificial intelligence stealing people's jobs, like that's really the number to keep in mind, that you have to push up layoffs to a really high level to probably get to that level of mass unemployment. Of course, hiring can decline and that can also raise unemployment. But to get to like the really scary levels of unemployment that people obviously want to avoid as a result of this, you know, new technology, we would probably have to start seeing layoffs at a much higher level, which would mean like, you know, many, many millions of layoffs each month. And so just be very skeptical of stories that are just pointing to like 1,000 layoffs at a few different companies, because it's just very unlikely to be enough to be pushing up unemployment to the significant degree that we're fearing.
Yeah, that might be a problem with how journalism is done. You know, people want the story right away and they think they see a trend, but as you point out, it's just not enough time to really see it.
And I mean, that was, I think, the main, really my main critique that I was putting forward in the article I wrote on this topic was just, like the anecdotes are not particularly helpful here, especially if they're decontextualized. So it can be useful to sort of gather some clues of what may be going on. But if it's just layoffs in the range of like, you know, a few thousands across a few different companies, like in the tech sector or something, we can't really conclude very much from that. And it's frustrating because it makes it hard to like write clear and informative articles. But it's also, I think, an area where like, it's just really hard to basically incorporate this information into journalism that's not going to be like just leaving people like with more questions than they went into the article with. Which, you know, maybe people should just be more accustomed to like going into articles with that mindset that they're going to come out of it just being like, well, I guess I have more interesting questions now about what's going on, but I don't really have better answers. And I think we're at the point right now where we don't have a clear answer to this question of like, how much is AI disrupting the labor market? How much is it raising unemployment? And how much is it raising unemployment even for like new college grads? Like, we just don't really have a very clear answer. And so I guess another point of advice is just be very skeptical of anyone who's like, well, there's a very, very clear answer to this, and we've proven it beyond all doubt.
That was John Jay College Research Assistant Connor Smythe speaking with KBOO contributor David Rosenberg. You've been listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. Thanks for being with us.
This is Bill McKibben coming at you on KBOO, Portland, Oregon.
Are you a fan of early rock and roll, doo-wop, rhythm and blues, and 70s rock? If so, The Roots of Rock and Roll is the show for you, and KBOO Portland is the place to be